Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Thank you all for coming out tonight. I'm really excited to be here and to get to talk about this really important book. I want to start by acknowledging that we are gathered in a room together at happy hour to talk about grief and loss. So in the spirit of modern loss, which I think is both profoundly honest and also somehow fun about the realities of grief and loss, I want to just get a sense of who is in the room with some applause. So first, if you in your life have experienced profound grief, please clap your hands. If you are here tonight because you yourself have not experienced that kind of loss but have struggled to figure out how to support someone that you love who is, please clap your hands. And if you are here because you recognize that all of us at some point in our lives will run into profound loss and grief, please clap your hands. That's what I really love about Gabby and Rebecca's work. They somehow are able to, like, with precision, help you articulate what you're struggling with and may feel alone in grief, and also make it feel really accessible, which I think is quite an achievement. So I want to start with some definition of terms that you use in the book. And you have a really great comic about two-thirds of the way through the book called Grief Speak. And it's some terms that you feel like people who run into grief need to be acquainted with. The one of them that I love is ambiguilt. What does ambiguilt mean?
So ambiguilt is, and just disclaimer, we are not clinicians. We are not therapists. We should never, you know, have letters after our names that, you know, suggest that we are. We're just lay people who have been through it. And so these terms are just what we've lived. So ambiguilt is the feeling of guilt, the intense feeling of guilt that kind of crashes into you when you realize that you're just kind of having mixed feelings about someone dying because, you know, relationships are complex, people are flawed, and not every relationship is completely tied up with a nice, neat little bow when someone dies.
What is reverse comfort?
Reverse comfort is when you are really facing some serious adversity and the rest of the world, you know, the onus should be on them to take care of you. But instead, when you tell them your story, you realize that the onus is actually on you to make them feel totally comfortable because, like, God forbid you make them uncomfortable talking about your own reality and your loss.
Monday is on the list of important grief speak terms. Why is Monday on the list?
Monday's on the list because grief creeps up in the everyday. It's not just the anniversaries and the death-iversaries and their birthdays and holidays. You find it just in the everyday. And the crazy thing about Monday is no one expects you to be crying at your desk, or they don't know why, because it's just Monday. Mm-hmm. So I think our a seemingly innocent day, this is our definition, disguised just like any other, but you feel the loss, and it doesn't fall on a holiday or any notable date, so people might forget it.
And the thing is, there's a lot more Mondays in the calendar year than there are, like, Christmases.
Yeah.
Right, in the life
or
of
anniversaries.
Grief. Yeah.
Edible arrangement shows up as an important term. Why is that?
Edible arrangement, in case for some reason you guys aren't familiar with this, is it's a bouquet that you will probably receive en masse if you lose somebody, the way I received about 14 of them in the week after my mom died. And it is a beautiful, colorful bouquet of fruit whittled into floral format that sometimes contains, like, a little tiny marshmallow at the center.
Chocolate, if you're lucky.
Yeah, and it's like a little bouquet of fruit-based comfort that really just turns into a lot of fruit flies flying around your kitchen. And people send them when they really don't know what else to do, which is a lot of times.
And another thing that's on the list that I think really speaks to your approach to talking about grief and loss is the term closure. How do you define that word?
Are we allowed to use expletive?
Oh yeah. I think didn't the New York Times, an excerpt of this ran in the New York Times, and I think this one was
You cut out.
Yeah, it was bleeped because it was a myth perpetuated by people who don't know what they're talking about.
Oh. Beep.
Beep. Yeah. Yeah, and that's, I think, so to back up a little bit, before there was a book, before there was a website called Modern Loss, how did you two come into each other's lives?
Oy. Well, we met a long, long time ago at this point, several years ago, and it was, we were both invited to dinner at someone's apartment in Upper Manhattan, and it was very hot, and it was a walk-up, and it was super awkward because we just were invited to dinner to have lasagna at someone's place, and the only thing we knew is that everybody else who was attending had lost a parent. Mm. And we didn't know anything else, and we, you know, just kind of met each other and were staring at each other and drinking really cheap wine that the cork was disintegrating into and trying to come up with, like, things to talk about that were anything but loss. But then finally, someone mentioned something. Like, someone asked a question, and someone answered the question authentically. And then another person, and then another person. And there were five or six of us total. And all of a sudden, it was just this instant exhale. It was this instant moment of relief of, like, oh my God, I'm literally in a room with people who all get it. They all understand the backdrop of my life, that we could be talking about anything under the sun, but no matter what, we're talking about it against the backdrop of profound loss. And it's just this instant relaxation that you have. And that's where we met.
Yeah. I left that evening feeling strangely exhilarated just by the idea that there were other people who, like, I think I was 27 at the time of that we got together for that dinner, other people who were in my peer group who were experiencing something similar and who could really go there with me in a way that many of my friends who had, like, understandably couldn't. They hadn't lost parents, and my father and stepmother were killed in a robbery. They hadn't known anyone who was murdered. Like, they really couldn't go there. And I left there feeling there was that exhale, and there was also this, like, strange exhilaration. Like, I found my people.
And you mentioned your father and stepmom were killed in a robbery. How long between their deaths and this dinner party, how many years had passed?
So it was 2007? Mm-hmm. Okay, so it happened, so it was about 3 years. And in those 3 years, I did find my people as well through a support group for families of homicides up at Safe Horizon. And, you know, that was one way to find my tribe, and this was another. But it was about 3 years. And Rebecca, it was like, really?
Like a handful of months.
But I couldn't believe you were even there. And
me neither.
I was just like,
I don't know what I was thinking.
And you were like, it's already been 3 months or whatever. Yeah. And we were just like, that's so soon.
I remember actually saying, like, oh, but it's been 3 months.
Right. And we were like
intimating that was a long time.
Yeah.
And I was totally laughed at totally in a remember. Very, you know, supportive way.
And how did you lose your parents?
I lost my parents in two different ways, but very, spaced very close together. My mom, I lost, her name was Shelby, and I was 30 years old, and we had been camping on a family camping trip that was our annual thing in the Adirondacks, and my dad and my mom, they drove me back to my apartment in New York. It was very late at night. I was heading to back to the studio at the Colbert Report the next day to report in for duty because it was Labor Day. And, I was sitting on my sofa after saying a very quick and loving goodbye to them and still, like, disgusting because I hadn't showered in 5 days. And, I got a phone call that there had been a really bad accident on the New Jersey Turnpike and that I had better get myself down there very quickly. And I, you know, it was bad. I heard my dad screaming in the background. I was told that my mom was still alive, that it was bad, but I knew that was not the truth. And I don't know who's lived here in New York, but try getting a car on Labor Day at 11:45 at night to somewhere in the New Jersey Turnpike from Manhattan. Thank God my best friend is one of those insane people who actually did own a car in New York and insisted on driving everywhere. And she drove me down there where I found out that I, you know, my gut sense was right on. And so she had not survived. And it was terrible. And my dad was in the car with her, and he did survive. But along with survival comes memories and stress and terror and all those things that come with losing the love of your life and being right next to her when you lose her. And so it was a really, really dark time during which I had the pleasure and honor, but also the difficulty of working in daily political satire. And then 4 years down the line, and that period is, I could fill in, that's hours and hours of conversation, but nearly 4 years down the line, I was sitting at home and I was just catching up on work, and my husband came home and he looked very just gray. I just remember it so well. And he had said he just got a call and my dad had been traveling abroad and had a heart attack and didn't survive. And so I was, I was 34 years old and I had no parents. And I know 34 sounds like 34, you know, you should have your act together. But again, hearkening back to Manhattan, I was renting an apartment. I had just gotten married. I didn't have kids. I had just gotten my puppy. I thought I was really at the start of everything. And I, by that age, had lost everything and, you know, didn't feel like I came from anything anymore.
What do you think are the particular dimensions of grief? How are they different when you're in that life phase, when you're in that building phase of beginning your careers, dating, finding your partners, and you're also dealing with loss and grief and end of life? Like, how did those two work alongside each other in your lives?
We look at each other knowingly.
Do you want to take?
Oh, sure. I mean, it's a tough time. I think that, you know, when you're in your 20s and your 30s, it's a time when you're just supposed to be focused on building, right? You're supposed to be focused on the possibility of everything and what your goals are in life and mapping out, like, you know, all the career screw-ups you're going to make because you have time to make them. And maybe they'll still get you to your end goal. And maybe you're still going to, like, maybe you're looking to find a partner or just many partners or just figure out what you want or have kids or not have kids or get a mortgage. And, you know, I feel like at 30, at least in my experience, my life was full of possibility. I had just gone through a really bad breakup right before my mom died. So that was like doubly insulting and triply insulting. My grandmom had just died a few months before that, my mom's mom. So it was a terrible year of loss. And, all of a sudden, I found myself surrounded by coworkers who were all my age and they were all full of energy, just like I was. And they all liked laughing just like I did, but they were just focused on adding on to their life. And so was I, but I was also very much aware and focused on the fact that the foundational rug of my life had been yanked out from under my feet. And those just coexisted no matter what. Like when I closed my eyes, when I opened my eyes, when I dared like let my mind wander, it was just an enormous effort to put up the facade of that, you know, reverse comfort of making everyone feel comfortable when I was really going through hell inside. And dating, that's like a whole other ball of wax trying to...
I think that was one of the topics of our first dinner party.
Maybe the first topic. Yeah.
And what was it like? How do you talk about your family on an early date? Like, what was the conversation at that dinner party?
Yeah, I mean, it's always awkward. And like some people can really hear it, like just in the world generally. And that includes the people you might meet on J-Date. and some people can't. And but it's hard to really know when to go there with them because you can walk around it only so long. And if you really want to connect to someone, you want them to know who you are, and this is such an important, especially if it's like 2 years out of it. I guess I met my husband about 2.5 years after. You like, there would be this like space between us if I didn't like divulge that at some point early on. But yeah, so dating was, which I did for a couple years after this happened, was, you know, it was challenging to know when and how and who could hear it. As far as like work was concerned, like the two best things people said to me in the aftermath of losing my dad and stepmother in this horrible way were, don't expect too much from yourself. Like every day you get up and brush your teeth and, you know, you're doing great. Like icing is conditioner and bills and laundry. And that was really, my friend Molly said that to me, and that was super helpful. But my grandmother, my dad's mother, who just lost her son, said to me, don't expect too little from yourself either. Because I felt guilty really like keeping my foot on the pedal at work. I was a newspaper reporter. I was actually an obituary writer when this happened because, like, of course. Like, yeah. I've been writing obituaries for a year, just pretty much obituaries, like sometimes up to 10 a day at a local community newspaper. And, but like that permission to really go on with my life, to keep my foot on the pedal, to still be ambitious, was really helpful to me because I felt really guilty about doing that, about like nothing else matters, right? After in the shadow of this horrible thing that had just happened. And then there was, you know, court proceedings and, you know, cleaning up the house. And there was like a lot of other logistical things to deal with. But I'm so lucky that I was granted the permission to ease up on myself and get up and brush my teeth the days I needed to, and also to, you know, push forward at work when
I care about other things.
I wasn't actually given that permission, so I think it was a little bit more amorphous for me because I was working, you know, you had a hugely supportive group of managers and coworkers at your paper, and I actually had a group of amazing people at the Colbert Report. They're like family. Like, this show isn't even on the air, and we're like still all friends. It's just like a family, but it's also a daily television show that needs to go on the air every single night, no matter what. And, you know, that's a tough thing when you just have to do your job. You have no choice. And people are empathic and they're sympathetic and they love you. But there's no time at 11:30 in the morning to, oh, like a grief counselor has time. I'm just going to like hop on the M57. I'll be back in an hour and a half. Like, that's just not the way that it works there. That's not the tenor of the job. There's really no space. And I felt suffocated. I felt like I was given time, as much time as I needed, because I worked with amazing people and I loved them, but they didn't have to give me any time. There was no bereavement leave policy. Like, theoretically, I would have had to be back at work the next day because I was a day, you know, when you're in production, you don't even have like a 401k, you're just clocking in. That's the way TV production is. And so a lot of it was just kind of up to me, and I didn't have anybody saying, you know, you can be a mess and then also like keep going. I actually was desperate for a roadmap through this crazy mess. And I was just like grasping at straws and trying to figure out for myself because I didn't dare want to intimate to people around me that I felt so lost and I didn't know which way to go.
How much time did you take off from work?
Like a week and a half. You know, which looking back, I'm like, why did I just take that long? I took a week and a half and I was told very emphatically, like, take the time you need. In some way, though, that ended up not being super helpful because it left it up to me to decide how much time I needed. And I had no idea what the hell I needed. I was in shock for almost a year after my mom died. Like, I didn't really start feeling it for a year, like really deeply feeling it. And so I just kind of went into the mechanics of, you know, everyone saying structure is good for me and I should just keep on with my life. But, you know, go back to, you know, you're 30, you're working in media and you're working really hard and there's no space to grieve. There was just no space for me to carve out for myself because I'd come home exhausted and the last thing I wanted to do was be alone with my thoughts. So I'd go out because I didn't want to like stare at the wall and think these thoughts and these memories and the memory of my dad telling me that my mom hadn't made it and then the memory later of, you know, my husband telling me that my dad hadn't made it. And it just like was all so much and so existentially much. It was hard without a structure, without a company that said, this is our policy and it's a good one. Please take it.
So, go ahead. Okay. Oh, Rebecca mentioned something interesting about like she didn't really feel it so as acutely as she the first year as she did after that. And I really feel like there's this misnomer that the first year is the hardest. I feel like it's the most traumatic. It's the most shocking. Your body and your brain are getting used to the fact that your loved one isn't here with you, that you're never going to see them again. You might be wrestling with how it happened and why. But it also has the most cushions of people are like coming by with casseroles and they're like sending like trees from edible arrangements or like trees are planted in Israel and people are like, you know, sorry, I'm Jewish, if you can't tell, J-date and trees planted in Israel references. But yeah, people are like always coming in, checking. They're most likely to remember like the date of death or the first Thanksgiving or Hanukkah in my case. And then after that, like understandably, people go back to their own lives. And I really found like, that it hit me too. The second year was harder than the first. Like I'd say like year two and three were really the hardest. And also year one, like there are logistics. There is like cleaning out the house and like getting death certificates. And there's like actually things that keep you busy and your mind off like what actually happened. So I just want to put that out there.
So after you had your dinner where you met, mm-hmm. when you started thinking about what was the kind of dialogue about grief and loss that you had not had when you were experiencing year one, year two, year three in your case, like what did you want to provide by creating Modern Loss?
Oh man. Well, we wanted to provide a place, and I should say that we really waited until, you know, the idea for this kind of occurred when I was still working at Colbert, when I was like, why doesn't anyone want to really talk to me about this? Why is everyone saying, how are you, in the hallway? But they're like kind of looking slightly to the left of both of my eyes. Like they're like really scared to see like what might be in them. And I was scared to answer. Like I didn't want to like answer at like 2:12 on a Tuesday in the stairwell. I wanted space to talk about it. And I wanted to feel like I could actually talk about it in a way that didn't make me feel like I was no longer myself. And of course, I was no longer the person I was beforehand. There very much is a before and an after, but it's additive. You're still the person you were beforehand. You just are also all these other things, just like anything in life, parenthood, new career, anything. And, you know, I just felt like there was a real lack of space to have conversation that wasn't incredibly, you know, sorry, but patronizing, full of platitudes, full of assurances that were empty, that didn't really assure you of a timeline, just would say, you know, it gets better, it takes a year, you know, it will be okay. And we both, Gabby and I, are like, really? Can you please tell us how that will be? Because then we'll really feel better. And also, you know, humor. I mean, I worked in freaking comedy, you know? I wanted to feel like I could laugh because a lot of the things about death and loss are really funny. They're really, really funny. I'm sorry, but they are. And that's not disrespectful. I needed to feel like I was still me. Like I could still look at something and, you know, remember that like they put a shade of coral lipstick on my mom at the funeral home that she would never in a million years have chosen for herself. And it really was awful to see her looking like Tammy Faye Baker. And I scrubbed it off. I scrubbed it off my mom's corpse. And I can't believe I'm admitting that in public. I admitted it in the book, but I didn't think anyone would read the book. So. You know, but like all these things happen and they're messy, you know, they're messy and they're not like Gabby just said that the first year is like they're cushions. You know, when there aren't cushions, year 17 and people forget that, you know, yeah, maybe you're 80 and you lost your dad 70 years ago. You still probably have memories. You're still having triggers. I can't imagine that you wouldn't be. I'll be living with the loss of my mom for the rest of my life. And, we wanted to provide a forum for that, for sharing stories about the real mess of it all. And when I say the mess, I'm talking about the bad, the ugly, but also like the funny and the hopeful and the good, because we were young. We weren't four, but I would like to think that, you know, in our 20s and the age of 30 is not so old that we didn't feel like we weren't at the beginning of our lives. And we needed some sort of assurance and some sort of proof from people that in spite of it all, and maybe sometimes because of it all, it was going to somehow be okay. And life could still be very rich, because I really was like ready. I was like, there I am. I'm Miss Havisham. I'm going to like sit on my Jennifer convertible for the rest of my life watching Scrubs reruns. And that's my life.
Scrubs, how healing.
That would not be a bad fate, because that was a great show. But, you know, and so that's what we wanted to do. And Modern Loss is really, it wasn't a Rebecca and Gabby thing. We rarely have bylines. but it was for us to do professionally as editors and publishers and writers, but also like the Hair Club for Men, which is the president always says, you know, I'm not just the president, I'm also a member. You know, that's kind of like us with Modern Loss.
Yeah, I think we saw this like white space in the digital universe. We saw sites that were religious and that were clinical and in many ways served a purpose for the communities that they served. But we wanted a place where we could talk about like all the complexity of grief, the complexity of relationships when someone dies. Like, it's the ambiguilt.
Ambiguilt, right.
Yeah.
The things you're not supposed to talk about.
Things you're not supposed to talk about. And candidly and conversationally. Like, it's not... I think if you read the site, like, you'll enjoy it. If you read the book, it's like... It's a good read. It's not just... It's not just sad stories. They're like...
Sexy stories.
They're sexy stories. And they're like, yeah. So.
And I think the title of the site in the book is so interesting because... To me, when I think of loss and grief, the first thing that I think is like, oh, this is such an essential part of humanness, the timelessness of grief and loss. This is something across generations all of us have had to encounter. But there is something distinct about 21st century grief and loss because of the digital universe. And what have you noticed? Like, what is in a modern loss scenario, what makes it extra weird in 2018 to be dealing with grief that maybe someone in 1980 didn't have to deal with?
I mean, technology certainly throws a wrench into it for better and worse. It's a very effective way to get a lot of people to know that you're suffering, and that's not nothing, but it can also provide a lot of triggers. Like if you're experiencing pregnancy loss and you see other people's like thriving children, this is a story about technology, but not necessarily social media. We had a piece on the site by a woman who gets a reminder from the school district to enroll her daughter in kindergarten. And the school district just has the little girl's birthday, but she had died 2 years earlier of Tay-Sachs. Mm. And that's just an algorithm. There's no malice in that, obviously. And but technology, for better or worse, really can
be blunt,
throw a wrench into the process.
It goes so much further beyond the whole, like, LinkedIn still wants you to connect with your dead dad. And it, like, really still does, even though I've sent them his death certificate, like, three times. I guess he was, like, that good at what he did that he can do it from beyond the grave. I mean, he was a really good ad man, but but like, you know, beyond the persnicketiness of these little bugs like Gabby, you know, the internet doesn't care. It doesn't care. It's not trying to hurt you, remind you that your daughter died 2 years ago and just, you know, just twist the knife a little bit more and reminding you that she's never going to kindergarten, but that happens. And, but beyond that, we have a lot of control over what we put online and what we don't put online and how we translate online activity into really meaningful action. And I think that what's happening now is you say, how is it different? I think that these days we're living probably further away from our families, or we're moving around a lot more, that's for sure. We are probably not as tied to a religious kind of circle as we might have been back in the day, like if 1980 was the day. I think, you know, like maybe things aren't so centered around like synagogue and church because you're also moving. Like I'm like a great, like I love being Jewish. I love bagels and shmear. And I grew up outside Philly. But when I moved to New York, I didn't like run to join a synagogue. I didn't join one until they made me because my kid goes to preschool at one. There was no choice. And I'm so happy. It's a great place, Stephen Wise. But you know, it's harder because you're more alone and you're working really hard. And now all these devices that ping and ding and vibrate and like go off on us all the time, they're all over our body and they're in our car and they're everywhere and they're in our ears. And so we have less and less like borders between work life and home life and personal life and professional life. You can get an email from your boss at 11 p.m. And maybe that's the time you've actually carved out to just chill, just think, just, you know, absorb. But it's really hard because we're so addicted. We're taking a look, then it's really hard to get that email, that reminder out of our head. And so it's just hard to create space. It's hard to have space to process this, to talk about this. And then beyond the metaphorical space, you don't really have the physical space because you can't just like go down the block to all your family and friends that you grew up with or, you know, all these organizations that you might have centered on. So it's just, I think it's more isolating these days to be a younger person. And I think that technology really enables us to become more communal. But of course, once you put that down, the community goes away. And so what we really want to do, what we talk about a lot, Gabby and I, is like, how do you turn like a like? You know, it's like, my mom died, I miss her, like, or like sads. And it's sad, right? But that's not everything. You know, we really want people to do what we really try and do, which is still hard because we're busy, which is set a GCal reminder to like reach out to someone every year, like on a birthday or a death day or an anniversary or whatever. Or, you know, like we encourage you to like text, say like thinking of you, like, you know, with like a little smiley face, but text and say, hey, I'm coming over to like clean your bathroom, or like there's this great movie and we're going to go, and just like, you know, turn it into something meaningful.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
Will you talk about the Facebook group that you joined?
Okay. So I was telling you guys this earlier. My mom died before Facebook was what, like 2005 or something?
Yeah.
So she died in 2006. So she never had the pleasure. And I say pleasure because if you had gotten her AOL forwards, you would have known that it would have been a sheer pleasure for her to have been on Facebook and like, you know, tagging me and all these things and sharing all of, you know, the, and like Democratic movement, you know, the art headlines that she wanted me to pay attention to. But she didn't get to do that. And so I have really struggled with, you know, if a person was never online, did they really exist? I mean, it's really hard when you Google. I find myself Googling her name and it's like, you know, the joke is always on me. Like, she's not doing anything new. I find her name was Shelby Rosenberg, and I find like a yeshiva basketball player from Yeshiva University named Shelby Rosenberg. And I was like, God, that's not her. Like, and he's a dude also, weirdly. So I was searching for a real connection to her online. And I really needed to feel like she had an online presence. I mean, I didn't even have many digital photos of her because it was 2006. Certainly didn't have any like selfies. And so my son, my first son, Noah, he was born 4 years ago. And when he turned one, I really had a rough time because he was starting to take on like actual human person attributes. He wasn't just, you know, like not sleeping and like being an adorable baby, but he was, you know, reminding me of my mom. It was like, oh my gosh, he has her smile. Oh my gosh, like he has that look, like, oh, he has that little thing where he looks like my dad sometimes, and I can never pick up the phone to call them, and they'll never see that, and he'll never know where I really came from, like never, ever. And that's very hard to deal with. And so I started going on to Facebook and I found this group called, it's like Growing Up Jewish in Northeast Philly. And that's the name of it. And I was then, and they're like, did you? And it like actually kind of happened upon me, I guess, because I was looking at something similar. And it said, did you grow up Jewish in Northeast Philly? And I was like, yes. And I didn't. But my mom did, and she grew up, you know, right off of Busselton Avenue, and I spent my childhood visiting my grandmom in a row house there, and she had a great childhood. It was really happy, and it wasn't very wealthy, but it was a happy, happy childhood full of community, and she would talk to me about it a lot, and so I became like the voyeur on growing up Jewish in Northeast Philly, because all these people were saying, do you remember getting Buster Brown's at like, you know, such and such? Or do you remember Jack's Deli? How like, you know, the guy would always give you like an extra, you know, like half pint of, I don't know, caution bow ties. And I didn't. But it made me feel really comforted knowing that she probably did. And so it was this portal into what her world might have been. And I've really held on to that. And it's been incredibly comforting to me. And I'm hoping that the growing up in Northeast Jewish Philly people do not kick me out of the group now that I've admitted that I'm not one of them. But it's a clear example of how technology really can do something.
Hmm. Yeah. Very early on when we started the site, I guess in late 2013, one of the first pieces we ran was by a man who used to visit his father on Google Street View, his dead father, because when he went to go sell the house for his dad, he, you know, there was like a street view for like the realty company, and all of a sudden he sees his dad like mowing the lawn. Oh. And then he ends up going and visiting him, and then the story takes a twist when Google like recalibrates
Streets View.
and all of a sudden his father was gone and he finds himself mourning all over again.
Yeah.
And I mean, yeah. So technology.
Abby, how do you think about, like, if your job was writing obituaries, your job was to like figure out how to say the thing that was appropriate to publicly declare about someone's death, how do you think about that work now that your work has become so much about getting into the inner dimensions and the real, honest, frank dimensions of grief? Like, do you think obituaries, do you think of them as sort of this like precious relic, or what role do you think they have?
In some ways, yes, because a lot of local newspapers, like the one I worked at, have gotten rid of their what we called news obituaries, where they had to have like date of birth, date of death, cause of death, and you couldn't say natural causes if you were younger than 75. Very specific things. A lot of them have gone the way of paid death notices. I couldn't think of a better way to get into journalism because I had to fact check every single obituary with the next of kin. And so you have to get things right. You know, people are going to clip these, and it was 2003, 2004. People are going to clip them and save them forever. You felt a responsibility to get it right. And it forced you to speak with people as you were fact checking with the next of kin at like the worst moment of their lives. And I can't think of a better. And you know, and journalism brings you face to face with people who are going through a lot of really difficult things, and you have to find a way to connect and be empathic. And that it really just taught me so much that a younger generation of journalists, because you know newspapers are dealing with lots of financial issues, like they just aren't doing these news obituaries anymore.
And how would you start those phone calls?
Oh my gosh, I don't even remember, because literally the last two obituaries I wrote for the paper were my dad and stepmother the night I had heard. I wrote them in the format that I wrote every other obituary. And what I really tried to do with these obituaries, even like before, I mean, and we had such a dark sense of humor. Like I had like the police scanner like literally above my head in the newsroom. It was like those were the days. You know, I would just call and tell them I was fact-checking. And then I try to infuse them with life. So it's not like, you know, I'd want to hear about, like, why they were really into their VSW chapter or, you know, what they liked to eat or do or just something that brought life into this piece about death. It was so long ago, I don't remember how I started the conversation. I guess I would just introduce myself, but I tried to do it warmly. And you know what? When I wrote those, when people read those obituaries, because it ran in my local paper, in the paper I was working for, because I was living in that community, even though my dad and stepmother were, 2,500 miles away in Sedona, Arizona, where you don't expect someone to be murdered. these obituaries ran, and so many of the people who I had written obituaries for their parents or siblings or friends reached out to me.
Oh.
Yeah, so it was like really, I don't know if gratifying is the word, but maybe.
So in the night you found out, you started by writing the story of their death.
I did write it that night. I did other things first, but yes, I did. And I still have them clipped out and their little photo, like we ran with every obituary. I mean, I felt like the need to document it in some way. And like, that was the way I knew how, like, that's what I did day in and day out. And,
I want to ask you about dealing with stigma and death, because while death is something that many of us will encounter, there are some deaths that are more uncomfortable socially than others.
Mm-hmm.
What have you found, what's been your experience of having to explain that two people you loved were victims of homicide? Like, what is the way, when it comes up at a dinner party, when it comes up socially, like...
It's still always awkward, like... I was getting my hair blown out, like, just before I came here.
It looks great.
Thanks. And they're like, and you know, why are you getting your hair blown out? I just wrote a book, and I'm going to go speak at the Commonwealth Club. And what's the book about? And I tell them grief and loss. And then inevitably people ask, you know, what inspired this? And I'm always like, clam up a little, even though like, we've been running a site about grief and loss for 4 years. And we just wrote this book. And, like, I should just have my elevator speech down. Like, it shouldn't affect me the way it does, probably. But I'm always, like, kind of, like, gauging the room. Like, is this person who's, like, doing my hair, like, is it going to just, like, is she going to be able to hear this? Is it going to be, like, we were worried, like, I'm going to, like, scare people. That's the weird thing is, it's, like, it's a really specifically scary kind of death. And some people, when they hear about it, they're like, oh, well, you know, my mom died of cancer, so I couldn't possibly understand how horrible it is. And you know what? I really don't think they're, like, one necessarily is worse than the other. Like, on one hand, I can't imagine, like, seeing someone I love decline in that way. Like, it's a different kind of trauma. But with homicide, it's scary. Like, people are always coming up with reasons why it could happen to, you know, it happened to your loved one and not their loved one.
And they tell you?
You know, often, like, they'll tell you, like, they have an alarm, or they, you know, or,
oh, no.
Or, you know, or, like, that kind of stuff. Like, people mean well. Like, no one, again, no one says these things out of malice. They say these things because it's, like, really scary to think about. This happening to someone they love or to themselves. And I really found community that first year, that first couple of years, with two nonprofits that work with families of homicides. And they could really hear me talk about, you know, that this crime was committed in the, you know, when I was finding out things that were making their way into news reports about what had actually happened during this home invasion that were scary, that that, like, I couldn't say to my friends, and really they couldn't hear.
Mm-hmm. Did you find, for you, the process of the criminal justice system that followed their deaths, did it feel, on balance, healing? Or did it feel like it prolonged the moment of trauma?
For people who've had long, like, a lot of people in my homicide support group had cold cases or cases that dragged on. I feel very fortunate that they found this person who had worked as a plumber in their home and who's a methamphetamine addict and in prison for 10 years and out for just 2 weeks when the plumbing company sent them to their house. But I feel very fortunate that he was found and reprehended very quickly. And I personally am opposed to the death penalty, and it was a capital case. And so in the end, he pleaded guilty to two consecutive life sentences without the possibility of parole. So I didn't have to go through a trial. It happened in February, and by November was when I sent in my victim impact statement to the court. And I had planned to go and cancel my trip at the last minute and had a videographer come. And I sent, because it was 2004, a VHS tape of my victim impact statement, which I'm sure I will never watch again. Not only because I don't have a VCR, but because it would be too painful. And yeah, so.
Are there days for either of you where you're just need to take a step away from thinking about loss and grief and death?
Mm-hmm. Totally.
And how does that work with this becoming the project that you're working on, the site that you are tending to, the book that you're working on?
The thing is that when we started telling people that this was like our grand plan, that we were going to like, you know, open up the conversation about loss. We were like, here we are. This is what we're doing at dinner parties. And people would look at us and say,
"Angel of
that's
death.
Like so depressing. Yeah. Like, why would you ever do that? So morose. They would really make us feel like we were the Grim Reaper, much like the guys I was dating would very much make me feel like I was the Grim Reaper when I would mention that my mom was recently killed, even though I didn't say it in a grim reapery way. I was like just taking a sip of beer while I said it. But, you know, people don't like hearing or eating fries. Like mostly I was eating fries when I said it. The thing that people didn't understand was that, you know, it's like first had they met us, like you've been talking to us now for quite some time. You know, we're not like Debbie Downers. We can feel very deeply and we can be very sad and we can be very bleak. I mean, I had a very, very hard time for a number of years until I really started building my team of people, like finding the right therapist who really had a vested interest in me living a really quality life and really giving me confidence that I could just like kind of let it all hang out and like screw anybody who wasn't comfortable with that. And I really owned it and it really made me feel so much better and more confident. And so we just felt like we really wanted to help other people feel the same way. And we were very clear that this site wasn't, yes, of course, like all these stories are being told because a death happened. That's why it's called Modern Loss, because it's like loss that stems from physical death, even though there are so many other types of loss, but it's about life. You know, these stories are not just about like this happened at a funeral. You know, these stories are in the book. You see, is divided into all these sections. It's intimacy. It's sex stories. It's finance stories. It's secrets and intrigue and discoveries and identity issues. So in a way, it's just good storytelling. It's fascinating stuff for us to work with. And so we really feel like we're just telling stories a lot that are mostly about resilience and about how people are really building things, even just like because something happened. So yeah, like even with that, you still need to take a step back. And that's why I went to Florida last week with my kids and my husband and stared at the ocean for like 1 second until both children were pulling on me. So, you know, yeah, I mean, just like anything, I think just like any heavy job. I was counseled by a friend of mine who started a site for women going through chemotherapy, and it was a clothing site. And actually, she went on to do something really great. Her name is Emily Spivak, and she did this really great medium white tea store for Obama in Hawaii. Oh, yeah. After he left the presidency, she like made medium white teas for him because that was his dream. And she had done this really great project for her mom when she was sick. And she said, listen, you need to know that this can really weigh you down. This can be really hard when you can't just like put it away, when you come home from work and you're now living with your own stuff. And you just learn how to manage it, just like I suppose a physician learns how to manage working with people who are sick and who die. And it's hard, but you can't let yourself be a bleeding heart. I mean, that's just, if you let yourself do that, which I can be very much so, then you're actually not helping the other person and you're not helping yourself.
But the other thing is, having edited, you know, close to, you know, we have more than 500 personal narratives on our site. What's interesting is like, you can step back at times, but like I've never become desensitized. Mm-hmm. What would have made me cry, like a story I'm reading of someone, you know, losing someone they love or someone they had a complicated relationship with, day one still makes me cry. And I think that like, you know, tears and an occupational hazard. But I think if I'm not a puddle on the floor and I'm reading about someone who, you know, lost a child or whatever, then I shouldn't really be doing this work.
By the way, it's all about empathy. It's we're doing work that is really meaningful to us, and we're not, doing work that's not meaningful to us. And we just feel really lucky to be doing it. And especially at this moment in the world, we feel really lucky to be doing work that is helping people help other people. So,
Gabby, I want to ask you one more question about your most recent piece that you published today.
Okay.
Reading it, it made me feel so many things. You wrote a piece about this book coming out and being on a book tour while you were going through the process of finding out about an unexpected pregnancy, and then noticing your body, in your body, that pregnancy was not thriving.
Yeah.
And I think the thing that it made me think about was there's something about picking up the book that I wanted to feel these are the people who are experts about grief who can prepare me for profound loss. And you're having the experience of talking about grief and loss and what it is to reflect on it while you're experiencing a different sort of loss. And I just wanted to give you the opportunity to talk a bit about why you wrote that piece.
Yeah, well, it's so interesting. When you brought it up earlier in the day, I was like, I didn't even think to publish it on Modern Loss. I published it on a parenting site about this miscarriage, which ended up being an ectopic pregnancy. It was just a few days before the book came out and we were on tour. And so I felt like, oh my gosh, I'm a method actor. All of a sudden I'm talking about grief and giving my advice about grief and going through it at the same time that I was had this unplanned pregnancy that I was very ambivalent about. So I didn't even think of it as something do I have the right to grieve this? Because I was ambivalent, because, it felt different than other kind of losses in my life. But then when we were talking, I was thinking about all the people who have come to us and come to the site over the years. And, they said, do I have the right to grieve? My father died when he was 90. He lived a long life. Do I have the right to grieve? I was estranged from my sister who died. And we're always about validating, whatever you're feeling as a result of the loss. So the piece was just kind of me feeling just a raw explanation of what I had gone through during the 26 days when we were launching this book and we were doing live interviews about grief and loss, and here I was experiencing something very complicated or confusing to me and also physically traumatic.
Yeah.
But I'm okay.
Thanks for sharing. Yeah, loss comes in many forms.
Yeah, and just because you experience one kind of loss, it's Rebecca has this really great essay in the book. It's in our chapter called Collateral Damage. It's you think the world is going to cut you a break because something bad happens.
Yeah.
But the world doesn't care. And and just because you experience one kind of loss, it doesn't really inoculate you from other things happening.
Right. And not just loss, but your job could really suck.
Yeah.
You could have a really bad breakup.
Yeah.
Someone could cheat on you. I mean, all these other things.
Right.
And they can and they will happen at the same time. And those are the stories that we're trying to share there. It's it's not preciously tied up with a bow ever.
We have some time for audience questions. And I want to remind you all that we have time to share stories together over drinks while you get your book signed. So if you have something you want to ask about, now is the time to ask questions as opposed to sharing stories. But there is a microphone at the back if you want to line up so everyone can hear. While you make your way there, I just want to ask a question. What is the song that you play when you want to feel your feelings?
Uh-huh.
And it's a moment where it's I just got to go there. I need a release. Do you have a song?
Mm-hmm. I do. Take a Walk on the Wild Side.
Mm.
Let me read. It was one of my mom's favorites. And you will not believe it. This sounds you know, like, oh, it's like, of course, you know, but I was never this person. But so my mom died on exit 8A of the Jersey Turnpike, which is a highly insulting place for your life to end because it's like in the middle of New Jersey. Sorry. Like, you know, I'm from Philly, so you're just kind of raised to, you know, New Jersey. But, you know, it's like really not pretty. And in that area, you know, there are lovely parts of New Jersey, but that is not
8A is
and
not pretty.
It's terrible.
Okay.
And so I would be driving home to see my dad. It was an exhausting time of life. And I would be working in TV until late on Friday. And then I would take Amtrak or I would rent a car and drive to Philly and then be with my dad because I was so worried about him being alone. And then late Sunday night, I would go back to New York and do the same thing. And it was so exhausting. But there were a couple times when I was driving my rental past exit 8A and I would always freeze up. Like there were times where I had to pull over and I had panic attacks because I couldn't drive by. Like I was actually envisioning what happened and it was terrible. It was like I had PTSD for a while. It was a terrible time. And it was just when I felt like I couldn't hang on, like just emotionally, I remember pulling the car over and Take a Walk on the Wild Side came on the radio. Mm. And that was my mom's favorite song. And I just, wow, you know, like I'm not that person who's like, she's right here. Like I wish, you know, but she's not right here. But that moment, like I couldn't explain that at all. Mm. And I just decided to, I decided to choose to feel comforted, like to feel her energy because she had the best energy. And so when I really want to feel it, that's what I play.
Do you have a song, Gabby?
Well, so the whole like double album from Woodstock, my dad was a big, he was an SDS and he like lived on a commune in Oregon. He went on to like get his MBA and you know, live a different life. But that Woodstock, and there's like that song, like 1, 2, 3, what are you fighting for?
Yeah.
Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. Yeah. Next stop is Vietnam. So he was like, dropped out of school to protest the war for a time. So every time I listen to that album, I think of him. Hmm. Yeah.
Okay, we have some questions from the audience.
Hi, I'm Rachel.
Hi, everyone. Didn't expect everyone to turn around. I have lost both parents in the last year and a half. And I know that you guys probably have had some experience of people reaching out to you or based on your personal experience and thinking about, like, you know, life after all of this and thinking about, you know, starting a family and having kids. Do you have any insight you can share on how you're trying to maybe, like, pass that memory on to your children who don't have the opportunity to meet them? And
good question, like, Rachel.
Yeah, I mean, it's
we talk about this a lot, Rachel.
We talk about this a lot because, yes, first of all, I'm so sorry.
Sorry to everyone in this room, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's so hard not to, like, I have two little kids, and it's really hard not to let your loved one be defined by, like, the negative space that, like, by them not being here. I try to do things, like, on my dad's birthday. I mean, I try to do little things. I don't have any like great advice, but like on my dad's birthday, I like go out to a cupcake making place and make cupcakes with my older son. I call him grandpa so that he sort of fills that role even though he's not here. Like, so Grandpa Larry as opposed to just my dad. You know, try to pass on their interests and like make them real to your kids. I had a really hard time because it's like at first when someone dies, like the only thing they've missed is your grief. But like after a while, like my kid was having a hard time. I was like having a really hard time thinking of like what advice would my dad have given me because he never knew me as a parent, let alone like barely as an adult. You know, and so that's hard, but I still try to like channel, you know, when I'm going through hard times, especially around my kids, like what would he have said? What would he have done? What approach would he have taken?
I also do. So I have a lot of creative things that I've just had to pull out of thin air out of desperation. because like you, you know, I don't have a mom or a dad who are above ground anymore. And I also have an actual baby back in New York right now who's adorable. But, you know, he won't ever meet either one of them, and neither will my older son. And it always sucks. Like, it never doesn't suck. Like, I'm never okay with it. Not even, not now, not in like 20 years, I'll never be okay with it. And so you just, but it is what it is. And that phrase has actually become really powerful to me to just like remember that, because it is. And so one of the things that I do is at bedtime now, because my 4-year-old's bedtime is about, you know, 7.5 hours long. So he's like, I want, you know, he's like really good at bargaining. And he's like, sometimes daddy lets me have 2 stories or 7 stories, like one song. And I'm like, okay, that's like a million stories. So I'm like, fine, I'll tell you your stories. And I tell him stories about Grandma Shelby and Grandpa Ray. And it's my way of also making myself feel like I'm not going crazy by not being able to remember. And so it's actually like, that's a time. It's like a really meditative time for me, because first, I love telling stories. If you can't tell, I love talking. So, you know, it's just a really great way for him to get to know them and really get to know them. Like, I tell fun anecdotes that I lived in fear for many years that I was never going to remember because I was so wrapped up in the negative space. And now I'm remembering the quirky things, so much so that, you know, you saw the Facebook post that the other day, the letter that I posted. So we got a letter. It's a little insane. A letter arrived at my apartment the other day, and I ripped it open thinking it was like from like the dentist. Because they send like nice little cards from the East Side every year, but it wasn't. It was from Hillary Clinton. And she, was writing about how much she enjoyed the book and how moving it was and how grateful she was that it was written. And I, you know, right when my jaw dropped to the ground, and I was momentarily speechless, I said, Noah, he was standing right next to me, and he's like, what is that? And I told him, I said, this is from a woman. Her name is Hillary Clinton. You helped me vote for her, remember? And he was like, that's right. And I said, your grandmom Shelby loved her. And he went into his little collection of shells, and he took a shell that, because I would tell her that him how we would collect shells together, and he took it and put it on the letter, and he said, here she is. I know.
It's working. Those bedtime stories.
You don't
stories.
Think they're listening, but they're listening.
Oh, that's beautiful. Thank you for your question, Rachel.
We're going to take these next 3 questions, and that's it.
Hi there. My name is Michelle. My question is for Rebecca. So when your mom had passed and you were there with your dad, the time that he had where he was, you know, not with your mom, how did you help him through that? How did you, while you're still going through your own grief and loss, how were you there for him?
I'm going to be really honest with you. He wasn't really there for me. I was really there for him. He had lost the love of his life, who he'd been with for 35 years. They were 2 peas in a pod. I mean, they were like anyone who's in this room who knew them, like, you know what I'm talking about. They were just this comfort level. They were the couple who like always embarrassed me because they would just like dance in the middle of Rittenhouse Square when I was 14. And I was like, oh, mom, stop, so gross. But, you know, he had lost the love of his life, and he was so scared that, you know, not only that, but he had watched her die. And he had memories in his head that he could never transfer to me. Unfortunately, he tried to transfer them to me because I was so traumatized by all of this that I was so scared for him being alone and, you know, just being in this just empty, dark place, this home without her vivaciousness, that I would run myself into the ground going there every weekend. And it was really hard. I mean, really, I was like working very long hours, and I'd go to Philly alone, freak out, clean his place, like make him food, go out with him, try and socialize. But what I wasn't getting in return, and I set him up with a grief counselor, and I set him up with, you know, I called his friends and I was like, please invite him to this, that, and the other. I was like his little social planner. But in return, what I wasn't getting was like, how are you doing? Like, how are you doing? And he was a wonderful man. I love my dad very much, but he just couldn't go there. And he said once that he was scared that if he went, really went there, that he might never come back. He was really scared that he might just fall so far down the hole that he might never crawl out of it. And so because of that, he really couldn't bring himself to really think to be there for me. And it was really, really hard. It was really sad and really lonely. Really, really lonely.
Thank you.
Yeah. And when did you realize you needed more help yourself?
I realized I needed more help when it was probably a year, actually might have been almost like a year and a half or so after my mom died. And I had met the guy who now like I'm married to and have procreated with, and he's awesome. And you would think that everything would have been great and rosy because it's like, oh, the future I never thought I have, it's here. But I was like, well, why aren't I happy? Like, why am I going to sleep and having really awful nightmares of my mom? Why am I really scared to like close my eyes? Because I'm really scared of what I'm going to see at night. And why am I reliving this accident, which I wasn't at, but which I, you know, my dad talked to me about. He talked to me about the accident a lot. So unfortunately, he did transfer those memories to me verbally. So as much as you would think I was spared from it, I actually wasn't in great detail. And so I was really having trouble sleeping. I was feeling like the record in my life was really skipping. I was working really hard. I was like being told, thank goodness you have someone, you know, kind of like the platitudes, the assurances. And I was like, well, that's interesting because they're still not like my mom. It's like, you know, someone I'm dating is not a parent. And so it was around that time that I said I was in shock for so long that all the feelings really started hitting me. And I was, you know, diagnosed with PTSD. And it took a while for that diagnosis. I mean, it took a while for me to realize that I needed to get diagnosed. It took the therapist like 0.2 seconds. I hadn't even walked in. She's like, PTSD. And she was like, this is normal because you lost someone traumatically and then, you know, and now you're dealing with this with your dad. You know, you're trying to take care of everybody and you're literally not taking care of yourself. And I actually wasn't. I was not taking care of myself at all. And so it was then that I really found the right type of therapist who was not a talk therapist, a behavioral therapist who could really help me get to a place where that record was no longer skipping and my life could continue. And I could get to the point where I wasn't just scared to go to sleep and waking up and thinking about, oh, this awful thing that happened. But I was waking up and thinking about the awful thing that happened and realizing, okay, this happened. All right. And today's Wednesday morning. Like it's a new day. Let's get on with this day. And it really allowed me to move forward. And you never get past it. You know, you never get over it, but you move through it. And I wasn't moving through anything. I was like in a revolving door.
You were driving up and back mm-hmm. the turnpike.
Yep. I was circling exit 8A for a long time.
This actually is perfect for that. My name is Jeffrey, and I'm really intrigued by some of that tough part of grief where you're grumpy and you're nasty and you're stuck in a loop. And how do you separate trauma from grief, you know, and are they different, you know? But just I would love some of your comments about how maybe with your sight and the stories, how do you think you really kind of get to some of that really tough stuff that comes up as well, the destructive behavior and stuff?
How do we...
The unappealing side of grief. Is that what you sort of...
Yeah, the darker side of grief. Yeah. You know, the way it kind of shows up and how...
Yeah, I mean, I remember I was really angry, and I feel like a lot of people who've experienced like traumatic loss can be really frustrating to feel like everyone around you should intuit exactly what you need at any given moment, but people aren't mind readers. To get through it, just like having, you know, years of distance now, what really helped me get through like the toughest part was learning how to tell people what I needed as opposed to expecting them to show up for me in exactly some like totally idiosyncratic way that they couldn't possibly know. Like I asked my friend Lindsay to like time me on Us Weekly crossword puzzles. Like no one could actually know to like, that's what I needed. like that would be weird. If
I mean, we all need that.
Yeah,
really.
Let's be honest.
but, and then feeling like really like sad and disappointed in the people who like wanted to like show up and follow through for me because they like couldn't intuit that stuff. So when I finally, like I could finally let some of that anger go and work through it when I was like, this is what I need you to do. This is how you can help me. And it's kind of sad that, you know, you feel like, oh, well, then the onus is on you to make, to like tell people like what they should be doing. But in some ways, that's the only way to get your needs met.
Yeah. And we have a lot of pieces in the book. Like the book is, it's many, many essays, and they're not just written by us. We have 40 contributors, and some of them are famous and some of them aren't. And in the midst of all those, we have all these cartoons, and Anna mentioned one earlier, and there are a lot of practical advice. And, you know, again, not really by therapists, but like by us, and one is by a therapist about, you know, and one is, you know, I don't know if this is like being broadcast. So like expletive people say and expletive things that you should say instead. And there's really a guide because there are wrong things to say. There really are. You know, we don't pass judgment on the site, but we think there are wrong things to say to someone.
You're judgy and, about that.
Yeah. but also, you know, the reality also is there's another piece that's called how to build your tribe, how to build your crew, because it really is on you. It just is. It's the world, you know, you're not four and going through loss and surrounded by, you know, social workers and teachers or whatever. You're, especially if you're a young adult or older at any stage in life, where you're a grown person, it is on you. And it's on you to like find your voice. And it sucks. It's not fair. But like, since when has fair mattered about any of this, you know? Mm-hmm.
Thank you. And we've got time for just one more audience question.
Hi, my name's Vicky. You ladies are awesome. My question, all of us in here will or have suffered profound loss, but all of us in here will also be the supporters of people who have suffered profound loss. And what are things that people can say and do? And maybe the people who are close, but maybe don't have all of those personal stories of that lost one, or maybe it is that colleague who really, really cares about that other colleague at 212 in the stairwell. What can she say or do that won't feel like a platitude, that won't feel, and I know that the edible arrangements are received with the best of intentions, but that you sometimes then resent them, and then there's the flies around. Are there, are there things that the supporters can do and say that will feel comforting, that will feel empathetic, and that will really show the way that we care?
I mean, so we do have what Rebecca was mentioning, this graphic in the book, and some of the things we say, like, first of all, let me preface this by like people say, yes, people say the wrong things, but so often without malice, it's really hard to know what to say. Like we run a site about grief, and like, I don't always say the right thing. And, again, showing up, following up is like way more important, but some of the things we have put in that graphic was like, you can say, I love you. I mean, unless it's like a third degree colleague. I mean, like, don't say that. Don't say that to your colleague in the stairwell. Okay. But, like anything you're feeling is okay. Like you may, like if you did know the person, like a handwritten note or even an email, just for sharing some of those cherished memories. Like Rebecca has this great story about her mom's dental hygienist sharing some stories, and like people, when like those are so cherished, when even if it's just like you meet someone in passing, like I remember when your mom, like people were like, I remember when your dad came into the newsroom and this, like, you know, my colleagues would say that. And that's just, it was just precious to me to have those like full, like, anecdotes that proved to me that they knew he was a real person. So
anything else you can think of?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, like, I think for me that the nut of it is just making sure that the person is completely aware that you're willing to get into a very uncomfortable space with them, because chances are they feel like they are swimming alone, and they're not swimming, they're like flailing and drowning. And they feel like they, you know, like a lot of times, and when I say they, I mean like the way that I felt, that people didn't want to mention my mom's name or my dad's name because they like didn't want to like remind me that they were dead. Like, newsflash, I knew, you know, that they didn't want to upset me, or that, you know, I think that the thing that was most helpful for me were people who were just not scared to talk about it. And they didn't have to say the right thing. They literally didn't have to say anything. They didn't have to be poets. They didn't have to deliver, you know, a little, like, you know, a C.S. Lewis quote from Grief Observed. They just had to say, like, hey, like, tell me about Shelby. Like, tell me a story about her, or ask a specific question, because specifics are really good for people who are especially in the early stages of loss. You know, like, something specific about her. Like, what's a favorite memory? What was her favorite food? Just have them, give them the gift of being able to remember them alive, mm-hmm. because that's something that people really live in fear with, that the memories are going to fade, and they're going to fade really quickly. And I lived in terrible fear of that for a long time. And a lot of them did fade, but they didn't fade forever, because now when I tell my kid the stories, I'm like, oh my God, you're still there somehow. But just let them know that you're really not scared to get into the muck with them. And you can just say, I don't know what to say. Like, I wish I knew what to say, but I'm here. Like, let's get a beer. And if they say no, ask them again the next day or the next week, because maybe they don't want a beer, or maybe they don't want a potluck that day or a casserole, but they're never not going to want that. You know, they're not going to never want that. Eventually they'll probably say yes. And that's, to me, the thing that helped me the most.
Okay. So let's practice having some of these uncomfortable encounters outside over wine while you wait in line to get your book signed. Thank you for coming this
evening.
Thank you, Gabby and Rebecca. Congratulations.